The astronaut diet differs just a little bit from the Mediterranean diet. There's not a lot of fresh fish or anything with crumbs, and it has to have a long shelf life.
We've been thinking of this as the shuttle Atlantis moves through its final mission.
My name is Vicki Claris. I'm a food scientist, and I've been working with space food systems for almost 26 years.
Claris and her staff work at the Space Food Systems Laboratory at Johnson Space Center in Houston. There, they plan, prepare, and package the food for astronauts.
We have grilled chicken. We have barbecue beef.
Foods you might cook up for your own dinner table. The space versions, however, are freeze-dried or thermostabilized. That means they're processed with heat, like canned food.
The Space Food Systems Lab has developed about 60 different products for space. Claris says one favorite among the astronauts is shrimp cocktail.
It's freeze-dried shrimp with a powdered sauce, and it has horseradish in the sauce, so it has a nice little kick to it.
Okay, not fresh fish, but spicy. The food lab has also produced some real bombs, some of them too disgusting even for space food.
We tried for a while to come up with a thermostabilized cheesecake in a pouch.
Why didn't that work?
We finally gave up on that because when we did the processing, the color that we came out with was not acceptable. It was just very, very dark in color. So it would not be very appetizing.
And then there's Tang.
Wake up, you day, the astronaut's way. Wake up.
Astronauts are still consuming Tang in space.
Sadly, we cannot say the same thing for space ice cream.
The ice cream does not fly. That's strictly done for the visitor centers and the museums. It flew one time during the Apollo program.
The American shuttle program may be ending, but Vicki Claris's job is not. She'll still be responsible for feeding astronauts on board the International Space Station.
Our food lab here at Johnson Space Center is going to be as busy as ever. We're going to have 3 crew members to feed at least through 2020.
So they still have plenty of time to perfect, say, thermostabilized apple pie.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we have the latest installment in our Flying High series. We're marking the end of the space shuttle era by speaking with some aerospace pioneers. Today, we speak with Ellen Ochoa. She was the first Latina to travel to space. But first, to matters of personal finance. It's growing season in much of the U.S., and as farmers tend to their crops over the summer, there's one place where it's always growing season. That place is Farmville. It's one of the most popular games on Facebook, and tens of millions of people play each month. Players plow virtual fields, plant virtual crops, and raise virtual livestock. And you can't run a pretend business without pretend money, right? In Farmville, players use Facebook credits, a form of virtual currency, to buy supplies. For many players, that's just part of the game, but it's also serious business. Recently, the Federal Trade Commission was asked by a consumer group to look at whether Facebook credits violate antitrust laws. And beyond the legal questions, some people are starting to worry that virtual currency warps a user's perception about money, leading to overspending and some other bad financial habits. So who better to ask about this than our money coach, personal finance expert Alvin Hall? He's with us once again from our bureau in New York. Hi, Alvin. Welcome back.
I'm glad to be back as a future farmer of America. When I was young.
Really?
Yes, I was.
That was real. But you were really.
That's right.
What was your. Did you do livestock? What did you do?
We did livestock. We planted okra, tomatoes, corn. We had pigs. We had cows. We had fruit trees. It was a pretty big, substantial family farm we had.
So you did the whole thing. What do you make of this virtual currency trend? And apparently, Facebook credits aren't the only virtual currency around, right?
No, there are other companies that are doing this. And it started out in the gaming world so that if you wanted to buy certain products or you wanted to speed up certain processes, you could actually acquire these virtual currencies and make it happen. And then a company called Bitcoins expanded this and decided that they would offer this service on an international basis. So they offered this internet currency that you could then do person-to-person transfers between. So it's a world that seems to be growing, but I'm not sure that it's not dangerous.
Well, talk to me a little bit about why you think it might be dangerous.
Well, I think that plastic credit cards started to remove people from the reality of money. So you use your credit card or your debit card, and money moves in and out of your account. Here, you're playing a game with virtual money. And at first, it can be a very good learning tool to help people understand that you have to pay for some things and that the costs go up or go down over a period of time. But then, when you start to use this money in ways that encourage you to take greater and greater risk, it may be encouraging people to use actual money in that way because they're too detached from it.
And there's also crime in this realm, is there not? I understand
yes.
that there was a huge heist of Bitcoin currency.
Exactly. Bitcoin has an exchange business called Mt. Gox. And somebody actually broke into that and managed to pull out about $500,000 in valuable Bitcoins from that. So people think these sites are very secure, but hackers attack them because they see this money as having value. And what's interesting about that is that Bitcoins went from having a value of $17 to having a value of 1 cent after the hacking occurred.
But does this have any meaning in the real world?
I question whether it does. Bitcoins holds out that you can buy products with it. Mostly you can buy things in the gaming world with it, although there are a few websites that will let you use Bitcoins for that. And also, they will let you trade Bitcoins with other people. I think this virtual money is ultimately a little dangerous. First of all, what's really backing it? Is there a government backing it? Is there a bank backing it? Then, if people can do this person to person, what types of things can they pay for? Can they pay for illegal drugs, which, of course, every website talks about? Can they pay for pornography, LSD, all of that sort of stuff, in addition to real goods? So this person-to-person transfer, where there's no monitoring of it, does give people freedom and anonymity, but it can also encourage people toward criminal activity.
Well, but the alternate view of that is if the people, you know, just because actors may play criminals, that doesn't mean that they go out and rob banks, right?
Yes.
I mean,
oh, yes.
Or even if they engage in certain conduct that wouldn't meet their own personal moral standards, it doesn't mean that they're, you know, they're committing adultery or doing whatever because they're acting. Why isn't this just, they say it's kind of democratizing acting in the same way that the, you know, the internet has kind of democratized other things like news gathering, that anybody can do it without really doing it. Is that so terrible?
I don't think it's terrible if there's a moral component driving it so that people will not start to use it for illegal means. But anytime you have a facility that will allow for the large transfer of money from one person to another directly, eventually somebody's mind will start to say, well, not only can I pay for that sweater that way, or not only can I pay for that car that way, but I can also acquire other things. So I think when you have these open systems, everything starts out being about democracy, but then gradually criminal elements will enter it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about virtual currency with our money coach, our personal finance expert, Alvin Hall. What do you recommend? You often think not just about the problem, but about the solution. Is there
yes.
something that you recommend here? I mean, this isn't the only realm where many people think the technology has outpaced the ethics.
Exactly. So
what do you think should happen here? And do you have some thoughts about how people should regulate their own participation in these kinds of activities if they enjoy them?
I do. I think that people should recognize that these games are merely social networking locations where you can get to know somebody. You may discover that farming interests you in some way. But remember, it's a game. And if this game starts to encourage you to take riskier and riskier behavior because you believe that there's going to be a big payout, understand that that mindset could lead you to start doing the same thing with your money. So monitor your behavior very carefully. Also, when you're talking to other people on these websites, be careful that you don't become subject to undue influence by somebody who says, let's try this method. This may work for you. All of those things could lead you down a path that you don't anticipate. Remember, these are games. They're fun. They can teach you the basics of how to handle money, but they may not translate seamlessly into the real world.
Alvin Hall is our regular contributor on matters of personal finance and the economy. He was kind enough to join us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Alvin, always so good to talk to you.
Good to talk with you. I'm going to go and get my Future Farmer of America jacket out and see if it still fits.
I'm sure it does.
The eighth and final Harry Potter film opens at midnight with more than $32 million in tickets already sold. Film critic Kenneth Turan reviews the final Harry Potter movie for us.
Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Part 2, turns out to be more than the last of its kind. almost magically. It's also one of the best films of the entire series. It brings us back to the combination of adventure and emotion that conjured the book's popularity in the first place. Splitting the final novel into two parts enabled this film to concentrate on action. Harry and company search for the Horcruxes that contain hidden pieces of the evil wizard Voldemort's soul. Destroy those one by one, and the man will be weakened beyond measure.
He knows. You know who? He knows we broke into Gringotts. He knows what we took, and he knows we're hunting Horcruxes.
The trio of young stars, Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, and Emma Watson, are surrounded by a who's who of top-flight British acting talent. Alan Rickman as the devious Severus Snape has some of his best moments here.
If anyone here has any knowledge of Mr. Potter's movements this evening, I invite them to step forward.
And who can compare to the chilling Ralph Fiennes as the evil wizard himself?
The boy who lived, come to die.
All that talent couldn't have come cheap. And the other consistent factor in the Potter universe is the production's refusal to pinch pennies. The film's elaborate and expensive settings are enhanced for the first time with 3D effects which work best when the action is hot and heavy. The Potter films have rarely been daring, choosing superb craftsmanship over cutting-edge audacity every time. By this point, we don't need the film to be daring because the story itself is so involving. Near the end of the film, the great wizard Dumbledore speaks from beyond the grave and says, "Words are our most inexhaustible source of magic." It's not Harry Potter we think of at that moment, but his creator, J.K. Rowling. First and foremost, it's her we have to be grateful to for all these pleasures. And we certainly are.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp has suffered another major setback in Britain as it faces a widespread phone hacking and bribery scandal. The company has withdrawn its bid to take full control of BSkyB. That's the biggest broadcaster in the United Kingdom. As NPR's David Folkenflik reports from London, the setback caps a week of reversals for a media baron who once seemed unassailable.
Until last week, News Corp had little reason to doubt it would take over BSkyB. Prime Minister David Cameron has close ties to senior News Corp officials, and he aggressively sought and won the support of Murdoch and his four national British papers when running for office. Last week, as new allegations surfaced about News Corp's tabloid News of the World, Cameron was critical, but said the BSkyB bid should still be evaluated on its merits. Yet his tone shifted daily. By today, Cameron was fiery.
There needs to be root and branch change at this entire organization.
Under withering attack, Cameron joined the demands for the dismissal of Rebecca Brooks, the chief executive of Murdoch's British newspaper division. Cameron also called for News Corp to abandon the bid for full control of BSkyB.
What has happened at this company is disgraceful. It's got to be addressed at every level, and they should stop thinking about mergers when they've got to sort out the mess they've created.
Last week, News Corp shut down News of the World to ease the way for the BSkyB purchase. But public outrage led all three major parties to unite in opposition, and they plan to vote for this afternoon in the House of Commons. Today, News Corp moved again. Before the Commons vote.
Sir, it is unusual, to put it mildly, for a motion in this House to succeed before the debate on it begins.
That's Ed Miliband of the opposition Labour Party reacting to the abandonment of the bid for BSkyB.
Make no mistake, the decision made by News Corporation was not the decision they wanted to make. Yeah. It may have been announced before this debate, but it would not have happened without it. Yeah. Above all, this is a victory for people. The good, decent...
News Corp already owns 39% of BSkyB, but the company counted on the full acquisition to help drive future profits in the UK and Europe. The announcement that News Corp would drop the effort, issued in the name of Chief Operating Officer Chase Carey, said, quote, "It is too difficult in this climate." Former Labour Prime Minister Gordon Brown said he stood up to the company's plans for greater consolidation and alleged that, as a result, he became one of many targets of their unscrupulous reporting.
Not the misconduct of a few rogues or a few freelancers, but I have to say, law-breaking often on an industrial scale, at its worst dependent on links with the British criminal underworld.
The Labour Party under Brown sought Murdoch's blessing too. He didn't get it, and he lost. Today, his successor, David Cameron, announced the shape and scope of two inquiries he's requested from a distinguished senior judge. The first is a review into the culture of the press, how it's regulated, and its often cozy relationship with political figures. The second, a criminal inquiry, will examine allegations against the News of the World and other papers involving hacking mobile phone voicemails and bribes to police officers. Additionally, it will investigate whether News Corp executives covered up the scandal and why senior police officials shut down earlier investigations. Murdoch, an Australian who went on to become an American citizen, made his name in London. This scandal killed the tabloid that propelled his media empire and dashed, at least for now, his vision for the coming decade. David Folkenflik, NPR News, London.
And our last word today in business is recycling. British defense officials are auctioning off an old aircraft carrier, the HMS Ark Royal. And according to the Wall Street Journal, a Hong Kong-based investment company has an idea for what to do with it.
The company is called Eagle Vantage Asset Management, and it plans to transform the decommissioned carrier into a high-end luxury mall. Not just a place to buy fancy jewelry, but your one-stop shop for things like yachts and private jets.
Just your everyday shopping, then. The company's going ahead with this ambitious vision despite an EU embargo on arms sales to China, an embargo which the Journal says could scuttle the plan. That's the business news this morning on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Finally, this hour, summer sounds.
It's summertime.
Today's summer sound comes to us from a listener who was once a disc jockey. He spent 25 years in rock and roll radio.
My name is Lee Warner. The soundtrack of my summers came from Top 40 Radio.
Oh, now we're going to do the weather from the valleys and the mountaintops.
Ivanhoe 61400, WINS New York 1010 on your dial.
From a car or a transistor radio, that's the sound of summer to me.
KFRC, San Francisco.
There was a time before iPhones and iPods and satellite radio and car CD players that if you wanted entertainment in the car or at the beach and by the pool, it came from AM radio. AM, amplitude modulation.
1430 in Ogden, KLO.
Music, commercials, jingles. were important to me because I've lived in 20 cities in 12 states, in every region of the lower 48. I was in a different school every year between 5th grade and 12th grade. And the first thing I'd do in each new hometown was spin the dial to find a cool new radio station. Radio was my constant companion, and these are summer memories for me because my family always seemed to move in the summer. I felt a connection with the radio announcers and the music they played for me, and the memorable radio station jingle.
It's 3 o'clock and it's 3, 3, 3. Shotgun Tom Kelly just ready to go.
A summer sound from listener Lee Warner. He tells us he still does announcing for a living for the Muzak Corporation's voice department. You can hear Mr. Warner's voice in airports, casinos, gas stations, elevators, pawn shops, and business telephone systems. After all that moving around, he's now settled down in Reno, Nevada.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.